This program is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners. Show your support at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This week on Meat and Three, we're talking about comfort food as we explore its history, meaning, and different interpretations from around the world.
Donburi is just a simple, casual dish, but it's packed with the history.
Somebody might have their comfort food be something that they remember eating at their friend's house, but they would never have at their own home. Consuming foods that were eaten then can bring back some of those feelings from those times.
It's about creating these little breaks and moments during the day where you kind of feel present.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I love to talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. If you're just tuning in for the first time, all the previous episodes can be found in the archives at heritageradionetwork.org. I'm thankful for listeners like you, and I'd love it if you'd leave me a review wherever you find this podcast. For those of you with kids at home, I've been working on a new podcast here at Heritage Radio Network. Along with my co-host, Hannah Forden, the program manager at HRN, we've created Time for Lunch, a fun food-focused show for kids. We've just finished our second season, so you've got more than 20 episodes to catch up on, and we'd love it if you'd check it out wherever you get your podcasts. I'd also like to remind listeners that Heritage Radio is a nonprofit, and we need your help to stay on the air. If you enjoy this show and listen to the other great podcasts we produce every week, please find your way to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make your gift today. Today's theme, we can all use a little kelp. I love seaweed. It's fun to play with, it's beautiful, it supports life in the oceans, and it's delicious. When I was a child, I would spend hours combing through the rockweed and bladder wrack on the rocky coast of Maine looking for crabs and periwinkles. The weeds were slippery, but not slimy, hard and soft at the same time, attached with some sort of natural superglue to the rocks, so that when the tide came in, it was like a beautiful forest of waving fronds under the surface. I vaguely understood the connection between these and the seaweeds that would show up in soup at the Japanese restaurant, and I'd heard of the sort of factoids that school-aged children share with excited exasperation that seaweed was in toothpaste and ice cream, but I didn't really know much about it until I traveled to Japan and had the opportunity to learn about dashi, the base of so much in Japanese cuisine, made from many things, but always kombu, or dried kelp. These leathery sheets of folded kelp are rehydrated and taste like the most heady, oceany, flavorful broth. After starting to understand that essentially all seaweeds are edible, I started experimenting with drying them and cooking them. After I went foraging, just before COVID shutdowns in March, with Maureen Johnson in episode 177 of Feast Your Ears, I pickled some and dried a bunch and have been cooking with it all summer long. And then I heard about Atlantic Sea Farms. They're doing awesome stuff in the waters off of Maine, working with lobster fishermen in the off-season to raise kelp. It's not dried, but instead they ferment it into delicious, nutrient-dense sea chi, kelp kraut, and seaweed salad. With expanding distribution, look for it in your local grocery store, and know that you're supporting a great company doing excellent things for the local economy and our overall health.
Hello, Brianna Warner.
Hi, Brianna. It's Harry Rosenblum calling from Feast Your Ears.
I'm Bree Warner. I'm the CEO of Atlantic Sea Farms. I took over in 2018 after a founder transition. And our company is dedicated to doing well by doing good. And that is through working with fishermen as a way to diversify their income stream in the face of climate change, while also helping them mitigate some of the effects of climate change by starting kelp farms. And what we do is then turn it into several different food products for human consumption.
Awesome. And so you're based in Maine, right?
That's correct.
And is all of your kelp grown in Maine or in Maine waters?
It is, 100% of it. And it's grown by 24 partner farmers along the coast from Portland to Eastport. And as you know, Harry, because you spend time here, Maine is a pretty giant coast. It's actually got more coastline than the state of California. So, Portland is one of the more southerly points, and Eastport is one of the more easterly points. And we have kelp partner farmers on the whole way up. And most of them are fishermen. And when I say fishermen here, we mean lobstermen, because that's the primary primary coastal income along the coast. In fact, many will say that we're dependent on a lobster monoculture here in the state of Maine. So most of the people we work with are lobster fishermen who basically kelp farm in their off season.
Right. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. So I mean, the main season, I mean, lobster fishing is a year round endeavor, but the, you know, sort of most popular season for it tends to be summer, when there are either tourists buying it or people are sort of eating more of it than they are in the winter, right?
That's correct. Yeah, the lobsters go further out in the winter when it gets pretty cold. And most of our fishery in the state of Maine, most of our lobster fishery are day boat fishermen. We have 5,000 plus lobster license holders here on the coast, and it's an owner operator industry. So what that means for just kind of general terms is, if you own a boat, you're on that boat when it goes fishing, and you can't own multiple boats because you can't be on multiple boats at the same time, right? Right. So it's very different than other fisheries throughout the country because we don't have these big fleets of boats. And it's one of the reasons why we often refer to the lobster industry here as one of the most conservation-minded industries in the country, because it is really focused on preserving that industry. They put a lot of different conservation measures in place to protect that industry, but they're also, you know, on these small day boats. And so that means that they're sort of limited to a few months a year, or, you know, 6 to 9 months a year. And most of the fleet tends not to fish in the winter, although there are some who do go offshore pretty far with larger boats.
Right. Yeah. I mean, not only the weather gets a lot harder. You know, it's one thing to be out on a fishing boat in the middle of July. It's quite another to be out on a fishing boat in the middle of February in Maine.
That's right. That's right. And they're simply not inland at that time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, inland, but they're not, you know, in shore at that time. So you really do need a much, much larger boat. You need much, much heavier equipment. It's much more expensive to fish, and you have to catch a lot in order for it to actually make any money. So folks tend to kind of cut their losses after the inshore season is over. That used to be the kind of thing where people were able to do lobster and then shrimp and scallops and, you know, fish for multiple species to fill out through the whole year. But at this point, what we're seeing is people are almost completely dependent on this one fishery. And right now that might seem okay, because some of the best years for lobsters have really been in the last 10 or 15 years. If you look at graphs of what has happened to the lobster population, you can see that we have more lobsters here in the state of Maine than we've really had anywhere ever in the Gulf of Maine. I'm sorry, not just the state of Maine. So it's been this sort of colossal boom, and there are a lot of different theories and scientific assumptions behind why that is happening. And it's mostly attributed to, you know, Arctic ice melt that is then warming the water, coming down, creating currents that makes a perfect condition for lobster. But we do know that in just a few degrees warmer, and lobster babies are going to be in a really concerning position for survival, and they're not going to survive at the rate that they are today. So we're sort of in this boom right now, and it's not to say that lobster is going to be gone, because it's not going to be gone. But it's certainly not going to be what it looks like today.
Right. And I mean, you know, spending time growing up in Maine, you know, it was always sort of referenced and spoken about that the Maine lobster fishery, as different from, say, Canada or Massachusetts, was incredibly well and is very well sort of managed in large part by the lobstermen and women themselves. There are size limits that don't exist in other places, where you can't take, you know, lobsters that are too big. You can't take lobsters that are females that are, you know, that already have eggs, things like that, which, you know, I always found very interesting. And so, you know, whether or not that, what piece that has in the success of the fishery, I guess, you know, maybe isn't super well understood. But I find it interesting that you have been able to convince lobstermen and fishermen in New England. I mean, New Englanders are by their nature sort of very salty and, full of pride, but also sort of, I feel like, not necessarily always the most willing to change, in my experience. And, you know, so I find it's really interesting, but I do think it makes a lot of sense if you look at the lobster industry, that lobster men and women have sort of self-managed because they knew that if it was super overfished, unfortunately, like the shrimp, that the fishery would disappear. And so now you're kind of offering them another thing to do that they can do in the same waters that they already know, right?
So here's the part that is so interesting to me about lobster fishermen in particular is, you know, while that sort of assumption about New Englanders is probably in part true, I would say lobstermen sort of run counter to that rule. And the reason I say that is manyfold. One, like you said, they're very self-regulated. So you mentioned breeding females, and it's even more kind of exciting than that first brush is that what they do is if somebody catches an egg-bearing female, they cut a V-notch in its tail. So basically just clip the tail. That doesn't grow back for 5, 6, 7 years. And even if somebody catches that female lobster at any time before that grows out and they do not have any eggs, you still cannot sell it, right? So that is the sort of like conservation mind that they have. And the other part that's really interesting to me is they are all independent fishermen. People think of Mainers as seriously independent, fiercely independent even. But, you know, we have 19 cooperatives up and down the coast that represent a large portion of our lobster fishery. These are cooperatives that fishermen join, they pay into, they hire a manager together, they buy bait together, they have yearly meetings where they get dividends, they pledge at the beginning of the year a certain amount of their money that they'll be catching that year to make sure the co-op works. Like that's ridiculously progressive when you think about it, right? So take that group of people and they manage their own books and they recognize that even if they don't feel like the climate is changing, they recognize that they have, if the lobster doesn't come in at the exact right time one year, which it didn't in 2012, which it didn't in 2019. I mean, there's all sorts of cases that they just don't have any other options. So for us, it almost felt like it was almost turnkey in that we just needed to prove to people that they could make money from it, right? Like,
yeah.
So what we did when I started working with the company in 2017 as sort of an advisor to those who were running it at the time, and I'd proposed like, hey, you need more supply. I feel, and I'm a development economist by trade, I feel that fishermen could be diversifying their income through mussels, oysters, and seaweed aquaculture. The problem is with seaweed, you can't just pull the seaweed out of the water and sell it. Like, that's not how it works. So I was working with what was then Ocean Approved, what is now Atlantic Sea Farms, and said, just stick with me for a year here, where what we'll do is we'll provide them free seed from our nursery. We will give that seed to them, and then we will promise to buy back everything that they grow. Let's just work with two small farmers on a very small basis and see what happens. So it comes around to April during harvest time that year, and there's not much to do up in these communities in April. The lobsters aren't in yet, you know. So the farmer is hauling in a bunch of kelp, put it into the truck, and then he gets a check for it. And there's about 4 or 5 people at the end of the dock kind of looking around saying, oh, what the hell's going on over here? And he walks to the end of the dock and holds up the check and says, look, boys, this here's the future. And we had so many applications go in from that community because they realized it's not just these. First of all, this company's going to actually pick up when they say they are. Second of all, this seaweed thing has some legs. And third of all, old Keith just made some money there. Maybe I can make a go at it, right? So I think it's just a matter of, for us, what it's been a matter of is the integrity of doing everything we say we're going to do, building a system that makes people feel like their investment is going to be returned, and making it very easy for folks to do. I mean, I always say if the lobster industry were to fall out, you don't want to stick a lobsterman behind a hotel check-in desk because we won't have any tourists either. But like similarly with kelp, like these folks don't want to go market kelp. They don't want to make products out of it. They don't want to make a processing facility.
Of course.
They want to grow it and watch it go away.
Yep.
Right. So like that's really been how we've formed our entire supply chain. And now 2 years, I took over in 2018, 2 years in, we're up to 24 partner farmers. And up from 30,000 pounds in 2018 to 800,000 pounds right now. So it's, you know, and we have a wait list of 20 plus people that want to get involved. So, I mean, I think I think for us, it's just a matter of, you know, upholding your integrity and building the right system. And fishermen are willing to try things, especially the leaders in the industry, to see what, as long as it makes sense for the bottom line.
That's amazing. I mean, so let's talk a little bit about kelp as a food product. You know, I feel like we're a little bit late to the game here in the United States. Certainly in Asian countries, not just kelp, but other seaweeds as well, what we call seaweeds. I actually was wondering if you think that the term seaweed is a kind of bad piece of nomenclature. Because like, you know, when you travel in, say, Japan or Korea, there is not really a blanket name. All of the different kinds of what we call seaweed is eaten under its own name. And I'm wondering if you think in English, the fact that we use the word weed, which has a negative connotation in many cases, is actually bad for it as a food product.
Yeah, it's a, I mean, so the first and foremost, the stuff has to taste good, right? So yep. Like we can drive people to try it through our social mission and through our branding and through you know, our environmental mission, but like, they're not going to come back if it doesn't taste good.
Yeah.
Right. So that has to be the first thing that we do. And so we put a lot of work in the product development side of things. And we actually just won several natural foods awards in blind taste tests. So they didn't know anything about our social mission.
Yeah. I saw you guys won a good food award. Congratulations.
Yeah. We won a good food award. We won two Nexties this year, the Natural Food Expo Awards. We won a Sophie Award for our fermented seaweed salad. And these are all blind taste tests. They're all just tasting the thing and seeing if they want to eat it again.
Yep.
Right. It has nothing to do with our sourcing story. And that to me means we've passed that hurdle, which is great.
Yeah.
But you know, we are late to the game in the United States about eating seaweed. Having said that, I think in the past 10 to 15 years, I don't just think it's true that there's been an explosion in that category, mostly in the snack side of things.
Yep.
So people are calling them seaweed snacks, not, you know, nori snacks.
Right.
And similarly, that bright green neon seaweed salad, which someone described to me the other day as the maraschino cherry of seaweed.
It's a great description.
Perfect.
Yeah,
because you just don't know how long that's going to take to work through your system.
Well, yeah, I mean, and from what I know about that stuff, some of it's not actually even. I mean, it's not. It doesn't grow in the shapes that you see it on the plate. I mean, I guess maybe it is made from deconstructed seaweed and stuff, but it's all extruded product that's not actually in its original form.
That salad is imported dried, rehydrated, dyed with all the stuff that goes into Mountain Dew, added with MSG and sugar. I mean, it's just awful stuff. But, you know, similarly, those kelp noodles that everybody sees everywhere, they're like, why don't you make kelp noodles? I'm like, do you know what kelp looks like? Not like that. So, you know, I think like they, so anyway, all that to say, the number one importer, I'm sorry, the number two and number three importer of seaweed are Costco and Trader Joe's. We're not talking sort of this like niche market. So I think that answers sort of two questions in that. Like, I think seaweed is how people identify it and it doesn't turn those people off. I think that, you know, there's no real data out there. Like, that's one exciting thing about running our business is we're the first to do what we're doing, which is fresh seaweed. But we also means we have zero data on consumer opinions about things.
Right.
So we just have to use our guts. And, you know, I sort of hate the term sea vegetables. So I never use it because it's not a vegetable. And from just a purely, you know, science perspective, calling it a vegetable sort of makes me uncomfortable. But sea greens is something that we use sometimes.
Sure.
We definitely use kelp, which we grow. That's the varieties that we grow. And seaweed, you know, when we're making, we have a fermented seaweed salad. What it really was that an answer, a healthier answer to that bright green seaweed salad. So we figured we'd just call it that.
Yeah.
And, you know, for our smoothie cubes, we call them kelp smoothie cubes, not seaweed smoothie cubes.
Right.
And that seems to work for that demographic. So I think we're still learning a lot about it, but I will give the consumers a whole lot of credit in that it doesn't seem to be deterring the folks that would eat seaweed. I think the people that it deters are the people who probably wouldn't like it no matter what you called it.
sure. Yeah.
I feel like, you know, when you're selling something like seaweed, you can't expect, you know, 75-year-old white male who's eaten meatloaf his whole life to jump out of their seats looking for fermented seaweed salad. And, you know, that's okay. Like we can actually just focus it to the demographic that it makes sense for. And our products really reflect that. Like, we know that people who eat fermented foods tend to want healthier foods. They want to eat foods that are, you know, more, they're more interested in exploring deep flavors and loud flavors. And so we have three fermented products. We have a sea beet kraut, which is a really strong beet kraut with 60% raw seaweed. We have a seaweed kimchi that we call sea chi, that has a really wonderful deep kimchi flavor, but it has the umami of seaweed that you couldn't get in anything else.
Right.
And then we have that fermented seaweed salad. And then on the frozen lane, people who go to the smoothie counters or the frozen vegetable area, are folks that want to eat for their health and they want the green color, right? So our shredded blanched kelp that's frozen and our kelp cubes are meant for that demographic. And so then we'll sort of move out from our products from there. But right now we're really appealing to those who, you could call it anything, and they're just excited about the product. And so I think we'll learn a lot about the semantics of that as we go.
Yeah. So I've become interested in food foraging over the past, I don't know, 5-10 years. And seaweed is one that I'm relatively new to, but I've been doing a lot of research on it. I've been out foraging some. And my understanding is that there are, in fact, no seaweeds that are inedible or poisonous, at least not in the United States. So why kelp? Why is kelp the one that you guys are focused on when there are other ones? And do you have plans to expand into other types?
Yeah, so we, in the state of Maine, and I think this is a fantastic rule, you cannot grow anything that is not native to Maine.
That's excellent.
So it's an excellent rule. I mean, what that really, people are concerned about the, you know, it's not a closed system, it's the ocean. If you planted something that is from, say, Florida, first of all, it probably wouldn't survive because the ecosystem has a way of killing things that shouldn't be here. But also, you know, there would be a serious concern and a rightful one that could then be, you know, it could be seeded off and produce here and become an invasive species. So we really only have so much to work with here. And we also are really looking at the climate resilience part of this. And kelp is an incredible mitigator of carbon, of the effects of carbon on our ocean. So it actually removes carbon and nitrogen from the ocean and helps reduce ocean acidification locally. So that's really exciting. But then kind of the third part is it's the most mild of them all. And once it's blanched, it really doesn't have much of a ocean flavor. It has a little bit of umami, but it's largely tastes like a green bean, right? It's the introductory seaweed for folks. It's not, you know, it's not overbearing. You can put it on a salad, you can put it in a soup, you can put it as a pesto, and it's very adaptable and easy to use. So it's sort of like the, you know, the most the easiest approach. And then sort of from a fourth point of view, from the science side, we know how to grow kelp. We're working on you know, dulse is a wonderful wild harvest product up here. People may be familiar with it. It's sort of like a deep mushroomy taste of seaweed. It's much louder and more ocean focused, but it is very delicious and super nutritious, as is kelp. And there's quite a bit of protein in it. So when we're talking about how to work with a diet that helps support vegan diets and climate change diets and, you know, folks that are low on omega-3s and proteins, dulse is great for that, but it's never been cultivated at scale before. So we as a company are doing all of the research to make that happen. But we have a huge responsibility to our farmers too, right? We can't just say like, put out a line of dulse, see how it works.
Sure. You've told them you'll buy whatever they produce, which means you then have to turn around and figure out how to sell it. Yeah.
Right. And if they don't produce, if it doesn't work, like they still have to be paid for it. Right. So, you know, we are really working to see if we, you know, we're trying to work with scientific organizations and universities and also the federal government and state government for grant money to try to figure out that research, because if we were able to cultivate at a larger scale, it would both be a boon to our partner farmers and to consumers who are looking for that type of variety. Because quite frankly, from a foraging perspective, there's not enough dulse out there to forage. And, you know, I personally feel very strongly that, you know, seaweeds in general are some of our best protection against storm surge. They're one of the most diverse habitats in the world. Let's leave them where they are.
Yeah. You don't want people just clearing off the rocky beaches of Maine of all of the seaweed.
That's right. That's right. And if dulse is so sparse, and we don't know why, right, because it changes year over year, let's just keep it where it is, and then let's figure out how to way to add to the ecosystem rather than extract from it. And so that's where we don't do any wild harvesting other than, this year we'll have harvested about 40 pounds total to create of seaweed to make 800,000 pounds of seaweed in our nursery. So, we really are trying to find some solutions that could take some of the pressure off the wild beds from some of the wild harvesting.
All of us at HRN have been keeping busy, despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN provide a virtual table we can all gather around. Bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new show.
Now, we talk a lot about land-based agriculture and monocultures and sort of those things being dangerous, right, to plant miles and miles and miles of corn. Is there a future where there is too much kelp being grown as aquaculture in Maine?
I would say absolutely not. And in fact, I don't know that we'll be able to grow enough. There are a lot of studies going on right now talking about how seaweed does remove so much carbon and nitrogen from the water. And when you actually remove it from, you plant it and then remove it from the water, you're removing that carbon from the water. Or if you remove it and then move it to the middle of the country and bury it and burn it, that carbon is permanently sequestered, right? It's not coming back. And what we do know is carbon in the air, when it hits the ocean absorbs it and it dramatically changes the pH, which makes it more acidic. And when the ocean is more acidic, it has a serious effect on phytoplankton and shell-bearing organisms. And, most people can kind of understand the shell-bearing organisms part, like when you get those oysters and you try to prop them open, but they just kept crisping off. A less acidic ocean promotes better shell growth. But from a phytoplankton perspective, if phytoplankton just can't reproduce or survive at the same rate in more acidic oceans, and we often look at trees saying they provide all of our oxygen, when in fact a large part of our oxygen is actually coming from phytoplankton in the ocean. And so that's a really important key component to our own survival. There are a lot of pretty big ideas out there right now on how we could have, how much it would take to kind of keep the acidity of the ocean fairly constant to where it is right now and what sort of farming methods need to be used for that. Now, we're not going to do that. Like, we're not going to scale to that point. But what we can do is reduce ocean acidification locally. And we did some studies with Bigelow Laboratories in for ocean science, and then a mussel company here in town. And we planted their mussels underneath our kelp halo, on the outside of the kelp halo, and then way on the outside of it. And what we found is the mussels underneath the kelp halo were significantly stronger over a 6-month grow out period than the mussels far outside of the kelp halo. So the mussel meat was also dramatically heftier, but that may have been because it was feeding from the sort of detritus that was falling off the kelp. So it's fascinating, like just visually. And then we're also doing some studies with Oceans 2050, which was just announced last week with Alexandra Cousteau, who they're actually measuring a bunch of seaweed farms across the world and measuring the amount of carbon that is actually permanently sequestered in the ocean floor from the detritus that's falling off of the seaweed farms. So one of the farms they're looking at is a 400-year-old farm in Japan. And how much carbon has that created, has that sequestered down in the bottom of the ocean over the last 400 years? So it's fascinating stuff. And I think we call it the virtual vegetable because it really does, you know, you almost at this point can't have enough as long as you're using the best possible, you know, standard operating practices, making sure that rope and line comes back out of the water, which is very important, and doesn't create more marine debris, and that you're doing it in a sustainable way. And our sort of added point to that is also working with fishermen to help them adapt to climate change while mitigating some of its effects is really kind of a double whammy there.
Yeah. So I want to talk about a little bit more about the products. So, I mean, I'm a huge fan of fermented foods in general. So I think it's really great that you guys are doing fermented stuff. I'm curious to know, I mean, in other parts of the world, you know, you mentioned Japan, I've traveled to Japan quite a bit, certainly in Korea, a lot of the kelp specifically, but also other seaweeds, like what you're talking about with nori and laver, you know, those get dried. And what I see in your product selection, I mean, having been in the grocery business, everything you have has to be shipped cold, which is a whole extra level of like difficulty. And so I'm wondering if you guys, like, did you decide that the dry space just didn't make sense for your product or was, you know, oversaturated, or will there be dry products? I mean, I personally love kombu and I make a lot of dashi. And so like, I would love to be able to use, you know, main grown kelp for that. And I know there are a couple already on the market, but I'm curious to hear from you about, you know, product expansion or not.
Yeah. So those that are on the market are great, like Maine Coast Sea Vegetables up in rural Maine. They've been around for 33 plus years. They do dried, but it's also all wild harvested, right? So it's a bit of a different price point than what we have. And the aquacultured kelp that's coming, or seaweed that's coming in from Asia, you know, that stuff is often Maine Coast Sea Vegetables, like, just to separate it out, they're great, have an awesome product, do great stuff. We have no, you know, we just want to make sure that we see it as a kind of a rising tide thing, and we talk to them all the time. But the stuff coming from Asia is aquaculture, and it's often grown in pretty compromised waters, and so you get a pretty high heavy metal content, and it's often grown with questionable labor practices, right?
Oh yeah.
So we're growing here with 4 acres with fishermen, and we're paying them very, very well. You know, we just can't compete. And so we could go in hard on the, hey, we're dried and their stuff is dirty with chemicals and heavy metals and blah, 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 blah. But like, that's not really the argument we want to take, right? Like, that, first of all, that often would dissuade consumers, but it's also just not the way you enter the market. Instead, what we can do is, and also, oh, and by the way, ours is so much better that you should pay 4 times more. That's not going to work. So what we really wanted to do is figure out a way that we could get consumption of seaweed as an everyday product that wouldn't necessarily have to compete on price, because we quite frankly can't. We pay our farmers more per pound than you can buy it for in the store dried per pound, right? Like, we just can't even remotely compete. So we decided it would be, you know, also, you know, that the market is fairly saturated on the dry side, and that fresh seaweed is fantastic. It's the difference between dried kale chips and kale. It's a different use. Sure. And dried kale chips certainly have their place, but it's, you know, and like you said, dashi, like soups, that's great, but most people don't use more than one strip 3 times a year most.
Yeah,
right,
indeed.
So you know, it definitely has its place, and kale chips are delicious, but I'd rather have fresh kale most of the time, and you can use it in a lot more things. You can cook it in a lot more things. You can you know, sprinkle it on things. And similarly with seaweed, that it tastes very, very good right out of the ocean. So by processing the heck out of it and then rehydrating it to get what you want from it, it seems ridiculous. So what we decided to do is really present a new product to the American consumer that was all fresh, that kind of showed the beauty of the ocean, showed the full plant, and also helped us maximize the impact by, you know, every pound of kelp that we sell is a pound of cash that's going to a fisherman along the coast, right? And you can sell a lot more bulk if you're talking about a serving size being, you know, a kelp cube in your smoothie every morning, or like Sweet Green, we did a collaboration with them earlier this year, was putting a quarter cup in every one of those salads that featured it. That's a lot of seaweed, and that is it, because it tastes so fresh and good and it is like a green vegetable, it can be used in the serving size of a green vegetable, and that's really exciting.
Yeah, it's awesome. So as far as distribution goes, I'm looking right now on your site at AtlanticSeaFarms.com on the where to buy. And unfortunately for me, being in Rhode Island right now, I only see one place in the whole state and it's not near me. So, I mean, people can obviously order off your website, but if people want to see it at their local market, I mean, I know, you know, and have discussed on this show many times the way that foods get distributed. And so it may, in fact, not be that markets don't want to carry your product in Rhode Island, but there may just not be a good distributor that's sort of dropping your product off because it is a refrigerated product and takes a little more careful handling. But should people just go into their supermarket and if they don't see it, ask for it?
Yeah, I mean, certainly. So just kind of a little bit of background on that is we had a brand in 2019, we released Atlantic Sea Farms branded retail product, but most of our effort was really behind food service, right? So we were working with fantastic companies like Legal Seafood, Be Good, Sweet Green, Little Beet, Orify Brands. I mean, just like fantastic corporate partners, Daily Harvest, that were using our product, talking about our brand, talking about our story, and using a lot of product. And so our focus was really to grow with those fast casual chains and the meal kit companies, and, you know, really sort of get kelp on the plates of folks all around the country by driving trial through these partnerships.
Right.
And at the same time, you know, starting in New England with our retail brand, moving a little bit out to New York, and then expanding to California, say 2 years from now. Well, COVID clearly changed that. we were very, very, very fortunate that people do want our product so very much, and that buyers are very excited about our product, that we were able to pivot that really, really quickly. So in June was sort of our first release outside of New England at any scale. And we'll be in Sprouts, all of the Sprouts, on January 15, which we're very excited about. So our product will be available in those 350 plus stores, and then both coasts of Whole Foods in April. So, you know, I think if it's not there already, it will be there soon. But certainly if you're going into a grocer anywhere around you, or your listeners are, that isn't carrying it, that that should be, please, you know, shoot us an email, let us know, and definitely let them know.
Yeah,
because we're brand new to the retail side of things. It just started happening. We have a great team that was able to pivot in that direction, but certainly it has been a dramatic and quick pivot from where we were looking before.
Yeah. So, you know, I want to bring up, you know, so I assume that all of the kelp that you guys are buying from the fishermen are going into your food products, but I do remember as a kid, you know, when I would take the ferry out of Rockland to go over to North Haven or Vinyl Haven, and there's a great video on your site about a father and daughter who are fishermen, yeah, who I'm pretty sure in North Haven from the video.
That's correct. Yep.
You know, you would ride out of the Rockland Harbor and there was a seaweed processing facility there. And I remember so clearly the smell of it. And they were making, you know, they were processing it into its constituent parts that are used in things like ice cream stabilizers and in toothpaste and stuff like that. Is that business still ongoing in Maine? I mean, are there still companies that are harvesting seaweed for industrial processes?
There's a lot of them. Yeah, this is all, you know, rockweed and bladderwrack and all the stuff that grows on the rocks, sort of in massive amounts throughout the coast. And there's a lot of it here in the state. And, you know, there's very little evidence that any harm is being done to nature because of the way that people are harvesting. It's a very plentiful resource here, which is exciting, right? Like, it's great to see a wild harvest industry that really doesn't seem to have any environmental degradation effect.
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, the place where my family has a house on the coast of Maine, there's ever more, you know, bladderwrack and rockweed.
Yeah.
What has disappeared, though, from my childhood is mussels on the rocks.
Yeah, so, you know, I think there are a lot of reasons for some of the degradation of other species, but, you know, that the stuff for seaweed for industrial purposes is still being used at large scale. FMC is still there in Rockland. Seaweed is used for so many cases, and in your toothpaste, in your shampoo, in your food thickeners, it's in everything. But it's not the type of seaweed that we're growing, and it's a different sort of like chemical, or it's more of a commodity product.
Right. Of course. Yeah. So I have to ask, I was looking kind of a little bit all over the map, and you guys do have, you have really actually quite amazing distribution. I mean, I see there's some place in Alaska that carries you, and you have distribution in Hawaii. But I also, people who know Maine, I think will get this, but I love that you can buy your product in Monhegan.
Yeah,
because I just don't think of them as having like a huge grocery business there, but I love that it's for sale.
It's true. I mean, it's one of those things. We have been so lucky here in the state. I did a presentation the other day, and I was talking about the space of a community in which you live, and I was talking to people from, there were several on their panel from all over the country, and I realized about halfway through my conversation that what I was saying is completely foreign to most people. Like the fact that we're a Maine lobster and a Maine kelp company working with fishermen means that it's in every fishing town that has a grocery store.
Right.
Because people want to support it because they know the Millers. They know the Browns. They know the Baines. Like it's amazing to me how much our community has rallied behind us in a huge way. Like yesterday I had a wonderful chef from the state call me and say, hey, we're going to make some dried pasta and we just really want to feature your kelp in it because what you guys are doing is great. And I think that this state and our coast in particular is just so supportive of innovation and so supportive once people realize that you're here doing the right thing and you mean what you say. Like before COVID, like I said, 80% of our accounts dropped out overnight.
Yeah.
But we sent an email to all of our partner farmers saying there's a lot to worry about right now, but us showing up is not one of the things you should worry about. We will be there and we will buy every blade of kelp that you grow.
Right.
That doesn't mean I wasn't panicking on the other side of that, but I knew, that if it was the last thing that we did, we would buy all of that kelp from them. And that is something that people hear about. That email has been cited to me by people I didn't even know knew a fisherman. I think that that's where, in Maine, people, if you prove here that you're doing the right thing and you're doing it for the right reasons, people will back you up. So yeah, our product's available in Eastport. It's available in Monhegan. It's available everywhere. And one of our partner farmers, Karen Cooper up in North Haven, her picture's on the back of our smoothie cubes. So they were the first store. The store out there was the first store to have our smoothie cubes because she said, get it out to us before anyone else does.
Right.
That's my smoothie cubes, right?
Right.
And that's pretty, it's an amazing place to work. I'm not of the place. I'm not from Maine. I moved here about 8 years ago. My husband's a Mainer. But I've never found a place more supportive and innovative and excited about community as I have here.
I guess I have one more question. And then if you have anything else that you feel like you didn't cover, please jump in. Do you have any kind of estimate of how much kelp you eat in a year?
How much kelp I eat?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. That is a great question. I eat it every day in some form or another, and I'm constantly in the kitchen coming up with new ideas. I always joke that I have product ideas for the next 10 years.
Cool.
So, I eat it every day. It's really great for thyroid function. It's great for metabolism boosts. It has more calcium than any food per ounce on the planet. So it's just, the more I know about kelp, the more I want to eat it, which seems to be the opposite for a lot of people in food, right? The more they know about the food that they're providing, the less they want to eat it. And in fact, for me, it's very different. So I eat it a lot. Plus, I try every batch that gets pushed through our processing line. Myself and or my production manager try every single batch that goes out. So that's a lot of kelp.
Yeah, it is. Well, and, so I guess everybody should be eating as much kelp as you.
I mean, I would love that if they did, certainly.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And, people can find out more at AtlanticSeaFarms.com, and you can bug your grocer to carry their delicious seaweed salad, sea chi, and sea beet kraut, and their kelp and kelp cubes in the freezer.
Harry, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to Feast Your Ears today. You can check out Atlantic Sea Farms at atlanticseafarms.com. They ship nationwide, so there's no excuse not to get some. You can follow them at Atlantic Sea Farms on Instagram to see more. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org, on iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please reach out to me if you have any questions. You can find me on email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can follow me on Instagram, @thefoodballer. Feast Your Ears is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter, @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.